particularly in the line of animal waste. Likely the captured had done the same during their passage along this same road. However, other than the odd corpse, there was no sign that they had passed through. There were no dung piles now, no gnawed discarded bones, no vegetable waste, no ashes from charcoal braziers, nothing. Only human bodies lasted, and they became thoroughly desiccated. I would have to take it up with Mergen. Meantime, it was a mental exercise that would keep me from dwelling upon Bucket. We trudged on southward. The rain came and went, never more than a drizzle, though sometimes the wind brought it stinging in from a sharp angle. I shivered a lot, and worried about it getting cold enough to sleet or snow. No other evil found us. Eventually I spied the vague silhouette of our initial destination, that mysterious central fortress. The wind began to blow steadily. Some of the men complained about the cold. Some complained about the wet. Quite a few complained about the menu. And a handful insisted on complaining about all the complaining. I sensed few positive feelings concerning what we were doing. I felt very much alone, almost abandoned. The whole day long, despite well-meant efforts from Swan, Sara, and quite a few others. Only Uncle Doge did not bother, because even at this late date he remained piqued, because I would not enlist as his apprentice. He continued his emotional machinations. Several times I caught myself retreating into my away place and had to remind me that I did not need to go there now. None of those people could hurt me anymore. Not if I did not let them. I controlled their reality. They survived only in my memory. Even that is immortality of a sort. We Vedna believe in ghosts, and we believe in evil. I wondered if the Guni might not be onto something after all. For them, the pain inspired by the departure of loved ones is less personal and far more fatalistic, and is accepted as a necessary stage of life that does not end with this one transformation. If the Guni, by some bizarre and remote practical joke of the divine, happened to be in possession of a more accurate theology, I must have been a bad, bad girl in a previous life. I sure hope I had fun. Forgive me, O Lord of the Hours, who art merciful and compassionate. I have sinned in my heart. Thou art God. There can be no other. Chapter 78. There were flakes of snow in the air whenever the wind took to loafing. Then each time it found renewed ambition, it hurled tiny flecks of ice that stung my face and hands. Though it sounded fearful, the level of grumbling never reached suggestions of mutiny. Willow Swan trotted up and down the column gossiping and dropping reminders that we had nowhere to go but straight ahead. The weather did not hamper him at all. He seemed to find it invigorating. He kept telling everyone how wonderful it would be once we got some real snow, say 4 or 5 feet. The world would look better then, yes, sir, he guaranteed it. He grew up in stuff like that, and it made a real man out of you. With equal frequency, I overheard some advice, the fulfillment of which was physically impossible for anyone not some select variety of worm. As often the people cried out, offering up impassioned pleas to One-Eye, Goblin, even Tobo, to fill Swan's mouth with quick-setting mortar. "Are you having fun?" I asked him. "Oh, yeah. And they're not blaming you for anything, either." His boyish grin told me he was not being some kind of unwanted hero. He was playing games with me, too. All Northerners seem to have that capacity for play. Even the captain and lady, sometimes, had shown signs with one another. And One-Eye and Goblin. The little black wizard's stroke may have been a godsend. I could not imagine those two missing an opportunity for screwing up as grand as this one was, if they were both in excellent health. When I suggested something of the sort to Swan, he failed to understand. Once I explained, he observed, "You're missing the point, Sleepy. Unless they're extremely drunk, those two won't do anything dangerous to anybody but themselves. I'm on the outside, and I recognized that 20 years ago. How could you miss it?" "You're right. And I do know that. I'm just looking for things to go wrong. I get gloomy when I try to prepare myself for the worst. How come you're so cheerful?"
"Right up ahead, another day, 2 maximum. I get to say hi to my old buddy's Cordian Blade."
I looked at him askance. Could he be the only one of us more excited than frightened by the possibility inherent in releasing the captured? Only one of those people had not spent the past 15 years trapped inside his own mind. And I was not convinced that Mergen was not working overtime to maintain a false facade of sanity. The others, I did not doubt that quite a few would come forth stark raving mad. Nor did the rest. Nowhere was that fear more evident than in the Radisha. Tajik had remained almost invisible since she had rejoined us this side of the Danda Presh. Though Riverwalker and Runmust stayed close, she needed no watching and made few demands. She stayed to herself, cloaked in brooding. The farther we moved from Taglios, the nearer we approached her brother, the more withdrawn she became. On the road after the Grove of Doom, we had become almost sisterly. But the pendulum had been swinging the other way ever since Jaikur, and we had not exchanged 100 words a week this side of the mountains. That did not please me. I enjoyed her company, conversation and slashing wit. Even Master Santaraxita had had no luck drawing her out lately. Though she had developed an affection for his scholarly drollery. Between them, the pair could gut and flints a fool's argument faster than a master butcher ever cleaned a chicken. I mentioned the problem to Willow Swan.
"I'll bet it's not her brother that's bothering her. He wouldn't be the biggest thing anyway. I guess she's down about not being able to go back, ever since she realized we're probably on a one-wayer here. She's been in a black depression."
"It's Raja Dharma. That's not just a handy propaganda slogan for her, Sleepy. She takes being the ruler of Taglios seriously. You got her strolling on down here month after month, seeing what the Protector did in her name. You have to understand that she's going to be upset about the way she let herself get used. And then she has to face the fact that she'll probably never get a chance to do anything about it. She's not that hard to understand."
But he had been close to her for 30 years.
"We're going back."
"Oh, sure. And on the one chance in a zillion that we really do, who's going to have an army waiting? Can you say Soulcatcher?"
"Sure. And I can also say she'll forget us in 6 months. She'll find a more interesting game to play."
"And can you say Water sleeps? So can Soulcatcher, Sleepy. You don't know her. Nobody does. Except maybe Lady, a little. But I got closer than most for a while. Not exactly by choice, but there I was. I tried to pay attention for what good it would do me. She isn't entirely inhuman, and she isn't as vain and heedless as she might want the world to think. Bottom line, you need to keep one critical fact firmly in mind when you're thinking about Soulcatcher. And that is that she's still alive in a world where her deadliest enemy was the Lady of the Tower. Remembering that in her time, Lady made the Shadow Masters look like unschooled bullies."
"You're really wound today, aren't you?"
"Just stating the facts."
"Here's one of your own right back. Water sleeps. The woman who used to be the Lady of the Tower will be back on her feet in another few days."
"You'd better ask Mergen if he thinks she'll want to bother getting up. I'll bet you it's not this cold where she's at."
The breeze on the plain had begun to gnaw both deeply and relentlessly. I did not disagree, even though he knew the truth. He might not remember, but he must have helped Soulcatcher move the captured into the ice caverns where they lay imprisoned. A murder of crows appeared from the north, fighting the wind. they had very little to say to one another. They circled a few times, then fought for altitude and rode the breeze toward Mama. They would not have much to report. We began to find more bodies, sometimes in twos and threes. A fair number of the captured had not been caught at all. I recalled Mergen's report that almost half the party made a break for the world after Soulcatcher got loose. Here they were. I did not remember most of them. They were Taglian or Jekuri, rather than old crew. Mostly. Which meant they had enlisted, while I was up north on Mergen's behalf. We came upon Suyin Din Duke, Bucket's Nyuengbo bodyguard. Duke's body had been prepared neatly for ceremonial farewells. That Bucket had paused in the midst of terror to honor one of the quietest and most unobtrusive of the Nyuengbo companions spoke volumes about the character of my adopted father, and that of Duke. Bucket had refused to accept protection. He did not want a bodyguard, and Suyin Din Duke had refused to go away. He had felt called by a power far superior to Bucket's will. I believe they became friends when nobody was looking. I began to shed the tears that had not come when we had found Bucket himself. Willow Swan and Suvrin tried to comfort me. Both were uneasy with the effort, not quite knowing if hugging would be acceptable. It sure would have been, but I did not know how to let them know without saying it. That would have embarrassed me too much. Sara provided the comfort as the Nyuengbo gathered to honor one of their own. Swan woofed. The white crow had landed on his left shoulder and pecked at his ear. It studied the dead man with one eye and the rest of us with the other. Uncle Doge observed,
"Your friend was supremely confident that someone would come this way again, Annalist. He left Duke in the attitude called in respect of patient repose, which we do when a proper funeral has to be delayed. Neither gods nor devils disturb the dead while they lie so disposed."
I sniffled. "Water sleeps, Uncle. Bucket believed. He knew we'd come." Bucket's belief had been stronger than mine. Mine barely survived the Kielanae Wars. Without Sarah's relentless desire to resurrect Mergen, I would not have come through the times of despair. I would not have become strong enough to endure when Sarah's own time of doubt came upon her. Now we were here, with nowhere to go but forward. I dried my eyes. "We don't have time to stand around talking. Our resources are painfully finite. Let's load him up," Doge interrupted.
"We would prefer to leave him as he is, where he is, till we can send him off with the appropriate ceremonies."
"And those would be?"
"What?"
"I haven't seen many dead Nyuengbo since the siege of Jaekor. You people do a good job of dancing around death. But I have seen a few of your tribe dead, and there wasn't any obviously necessary funeral ritual. Some got burned on the ghats, as though they were Goonie. I saw one man buried in the ground, as if he were Vedna. I've even seen a corpse rubbed with bad-smelling unguents, then wrapped like a mummy and hung head down from a high tree branch." Doge said,
"Each funeral would have been appropriate to the person and situation, I'm sure. What's done with the flesh isn't critical. The ceremonies are intended to ease the soul's transition to its new state. They are absolutely essential. If they are not observed, the dead man's spirit may be compelled to wander the earth indefinitely."
"As ghosts? Or dreamwalkers?" Doge seemed startled.
Ghosts. A restless spirit that wants to finish tasks interrupted by death. They can't, so they just keep going.
Although Vedna ghosts are wicked spirits cursed to wander by God himself, I had no trouble following Doge's notion. "Then we'll leave him here. You want to stand beside him? To make sure he stays safe from traffic?" Bucket had placed Duke at the edge of the road so he would not be disturbed by the terrified fugitives back then.
How did he die?
Swan asked. Then he squawked. The white crow had nipped his ear again. Everybody turned to stare at Swan.
What do you mean? I asked.
Look, if a shadow got Duke, and somebody tried to lay him out proper, that layer-outer would be here dead as a wedge too, right? So he must have died some other way before.
A dim lamp seemed to come alive inside his head.
Catcher did it,
the crow said. It was crow call, but the words were clear.
Ah! Ah! Catcher did it!
The Nguyen bow began to press in on Swan.
Catcher did it, I reminded them. Probably with a booby trap spell. By the time Duke reached this point, she would have been 10 miles ahead of anybody on foot. She was mounted, remember?
From what I remember about Duke, he probably saw the trap as Bucket tripped it and jumped in the way. Goda pointed out.
The Protector could not have left a booby trap to kill Duke if she had not been released.
Her tagline was the best I had ever heard it. The anger in her eyes said she wanted no mistake to be made.
Sara whispered, Suyandin Duke was a second cousin to my father. I said, We've been through this before, people. We can't exonerate Willow Swan, but we can forgive him if we recall the circumstances he faced. Do any of you really think you can get the best of the Protector face to face?
No hands?
But some of you think so in your heart.
Fu Nuang Bo lacked for arrogant self-confidence.
Here's your challenge. Run back and prove it. The Shadow Gate will let you out. Soul Catcher is on foot. She's crippled. You can catch up fast. Can you ask for any more?
I paused.
What? No takers?
Then lay off Swan.
The White Crow cawed mockingly. I saw a few thoughtful, sheepish faces, but Goda's was not one of them.
Goda had never been wrong in her life, except that one time when she had thought she might be wrong.
Swan let it roll off, as he had done for years. He had learned from the strictest instructress. He did suggest,
You said we need to keep rolling, Sleepy, although I guess we meat-eaters can start on the vegetarians after their stories run out.
Carry the key, Tobo. Thank you, Sara. Sara turned away.
Mother, stay with Tobo. Don't let him walk any faster than you do.
Kai Goto grumbled something under her breath and turned away from us. She followed Tobo. Her rolling waddle could be deceptive when she was in a hurry. She overhauled the boy, grabbed hold of his shirt. Off they went, the old woman's mouth going steadily. No gambler by nature. Still, I would have bet that she was fuming about what foul mortals the rest of us be. I observed,
Kai Goda appears to have found herself. Not one of the Nguyen Bo found any reason to celebrate that eventuation.
A mile later, we came across the only animal remains that we would ever find from the earlier expedition. They were piled in a heap, bones and shredded dry flesh, so intertangled there was no telling how many beasts there had been, or why they had gathered together in life or in death. The whole grim mess appeared to have been subsiding into the surface of the plain slowly. Given another decade, it would be gone.
Chapter 79
The ugly dreamwalkers returned after dark. They were more energetic in their efforts tonight. The rain returned, too. It was more energetic, and was accompanied by thunder and lightning that made sleeping difficult. As did the cold rainwater, all of which seemed determined to collect inside the circle where we were camped. The stone did not appear to slope, but water sure behaved as though it did. The animals drank their fill. Likewise, the human members of the band. Runmust and Riverwalker directed everyone to fill water bags and top off canteens. And as soon as someone raised his voice to bless our good fortune, the first snowflakes began to fall. What sleep I did manage was not pleasant. A full-blown tumult was underway in the ghost world, and it spilled over into my dreams. Then Iqbal's daughter decided this would be a wonderful time to cry all night, which got the dog started howling, or maybe that happened the other way around. Shadows swarmed over the face of our protection. They were more interested in us than they had been in the interlopers of Mergen's time. He told me so himself. The shadows remembered ages past. I was able to eavesdrop on their dreams, on their nightmares. All they remembered were horrors from a time when men resembling Nguyen Bo tortured them to death in wholesale lots, while sorcerers great and small spanked the demented souls until, when they were released eventually, they were so filled with hatred of every living thing that even a creature as slight as a roach was subject to instant attack, with great ferocity. Some shadows, already evilly predatory by nature, became so wicked they even attacked and devoured other shadows. There had been millions so victimized, and the only virtue in their creators was that they manufactured the horrors from invaders who arrived in countless waves from a world where an insane sorcerer king had elevated himself to near godhood, then had set out to take full mastery of all the 16 worlds. Uncounted tens of thousands of corpses littered the glittering plain before the shadows stemmed that tide. Scores of the monsters escaped into neighboring worlds. They spread terror and havoc until the gates could be modified to prevent their passage. For centuries, no traffic crossed the plain. Then came another age of half-hearted commerce, once some genius devised the protection now shielding the roads and circles. The shadows saw everything. They remembered everything. They saw and remembered the missionaries of Kina, who had fled my own world at the pinnacle of Raedrenak's fury. In every world they reached, the goddess's dark song fell upon a few eager ears, even amongst the children of those who had created the shadows. Commerce on a plane so constrained and dangerous perforce remained light. It took determined people to hazard the crossing. Traffic peaked when the world we recalled as Katavar launched a flurry of expeditions to other worlds to determine which would be best suited to host the cosmic ceremony called the Year of the Skulls. Followers of Kina from other worlds joined that quest. Companies marched and countermarched. They argued and squabbled. They accomplished very little. Eventually a consensus took shape. The sacrifice ought to be the world that had treated the children of Kina so abominably in the first place. Raedrenak's descendants should reap what he had sown. The companies sent out were not swarms of fanatics. The plain was dangerous. Few men wanted to cross it. Most of the soldiers were conscripts or minor criminals under the rule of a few dedicated priests. They were not expected to return. It became the custom for the conscripts' families to hold a wake for their bone warriors or stone soldiers before they departed, even though the priests always promised they would be back in a matter of months. The few who did return usually came back so drained and changed, so bitter and hard, they came to be known as soldiers of darkness. Kina's religion was never popular anywhere it took root. Always a minority cult, it lost what power it did have as generations passed and the early fervor faded into the inevitable, tedious rule of functionaries. One world after another abandoned Kina and turned away from the plain. Dark ages took shape everywhere. One gate after another failed and was not restored. Those that did not fail fell into disuse. The worlds were old, worn, tired, desperately in need of renewal. The ancestors of the Nguyen Bo may have been the last large party to travel from one world to another. They seemed to have been Kina worshippers fleeing persecution at a time when the rest of their people had become insanely xenophobic and determined to expunge all alien influences. the ancestors of the Nuangbo, the children of the dead, had vowed to return to their land of unknown shadows in blazing triumph. But of course, because they were safe on the far side of the plain, their descendants soon forgot who and what they were. Only a handful of priests remembered, not entirely correctly. A voice that did not speak aloud tickled my consciousness.
"Sister, sister,"
it said. I saw nothing, felt only that featherweight touch. But it was enough to spin my soul sideways and toss it into another place where, when I caught my spiritual breath, the stench of decay filled my nostrils. A sea of bones surrounded me. Unknown tides stirred its surface. There was something wrong with my eyes. My vision was warped and doubled. I raised a hand to rub them, and saw white feathers. No. Impossible. I could not be following Mergen's path. I could not be losing my moorings in time. I would not stand for it. I willed myself.
Ah!
Not from my beak. A black shape popped into sight in front of me, wings spread, slowing. Talons reached toward me. I spun, hurled myself off the dead branch where I had been perched, and was sorry instantly. I found myself just yards from a face 5 feet tall. It boasted more fangs than a shark does teeth. It was darker than midnight. The odor of its breath was the stench of decaying flesh. The triumphant grin on those wicked ebony lips faded as I evaded the swat of a gigantic clawed hand. I, sleepy, was in a trousers-soiling panic, but something else was inside the bird with me. And it was having fun.
"Sister, sister, that was close. The bitch is getting sneakier. But she will never surprise me. She cannot. Nor will she understand that she cannot."
Who is me? The exercise was over. I was in my body on the plain, in the rain, shuddering while my mind's eye observed the capering dreamwalkers. I examined what I had experienced, and concluded that I had been given a message, which was that Kina knew we were coming. The dreaming goddess had been pretending quiescence of recent decades. She knew patience intimately, by all its secret names. And I may have been given another message as well. Kina still was the mother of deceit. Quite possibly nothing I had learned recently was entirely or even partially true if Kina had found a way to wander the shadowed reaches of my mind. I had no doubt that she could. She had managed to inform entire generations and regions with a hysterical fear of the Black Company before the advent of the old crew. I swear I sensed her amusement over having quickened in me a deeper and more abiding distrust of everything around me. Chapter 80 Suvrin wakened me early. He sounded glum. I could not see his face in the darkness.
"Trouble, sleepy,"
he whispered. And I have to give him credit. He was first to realize the implications of the fact that it was snowing. But then, he had seen more of the white stuff than any of us but Swan. And Willow had been away from it long enough to turn into an old man. I wanted to moan and groan, but that would have done no good, and we needed to get a handle on the situation right away.
"Good thinking," I told him. "Thanks. Go around in that direction and wake up the sergeants. I'll circle around to the left."
Despite my nightmares, I felt rested. The snowfall in no way recognized the presence of the protection shielding our campsite, which meant the boundaries were no longer obvious. I sensed a heightened killing lust amongst the shadows. They had seen this before. It would be snack time if anyone started running around nervously. We had One Eye and Goblin on our side. Tobo, too. they could winkle out the whereabouts of the boundaries. But they needed a little light to do the job. One by one, I made sure everyone wakened and understood the gravity of the situation, especially the mothers. I made sure everyone understood that no one should move around until daylight. Wonder of wonders, nobody did anything stupid. Once there was light enough, the wizard started drawing lines in the snow. I arranged for teams to enforce the boundaries. Everything went so well, I was feeling smug before it turned time to go. Then I discovered that it was going to be a long day, which, of course, I should have known instinctively. This next leg of the journey had taken the captured only a few hours. It would take us far longer. The shattered fortress could not be discerned behind the falling snow. The old, old men would have to mark out every step before it could be taken, walking to either side of Tobo and the key, keeping him centered on the road, but never getting ahead of him. Just in case. A quarter mile along, I was worrying about time already. We had too many mouths and too few supplies. Harsh rationing was in place. These people had to be gotten across the plain fast, excepting those of us who would bring out the captured.
"This is getting out of hand," Goblin yelled. "If it gets any heavier, we're up Shit Creek."
He was right. If this snowfall turned into a blizzard, we were going to have no other worries. If it worsened much, we were going to die out here and make Soulcatcher the happiest girl in the world. She probably was anyway, now that she had had time to reflect on the fact that there was no one left able to dispute her in any whim she cared to indulge. Water sleeps? So what? Those days were over. Not while I was still standing, they were not. Swan joined me for breakfast.
"How's my wife this morning?"
"Frigid."
"Darn."
Open mouth, insert boot with manure veneer. Swan grinned.
"I've known that for years. Isn't this something? There's more than an inch already."
"It's something, all right. Unfortunately, I don't encourage myself to use the kind of language needed to describe it. Most of these people have never seen snow. Watch out for somebody to do something stupid. In fact, you might stick close to the Radisha. I don't want her getting hurt because somebody doesn't use his head."
"All right. Did you dream last night?"
"Of course I did. I got to meet Kina right up close, too."
"I saw lights on the road to the east of us."
That got my attention.
"Really?" "In my dream. They were just witch lights. Maybe the plane's own memories or something. There wasn't anything there when I went to look."
"Getting bold in your old age, are you?"
"It just sort of happened. I wouldn't have done it if I thought about it."
"Did I snore again last night?"
"You solidified your grasp on the all-time women's championship. You ready to compete at the next level?"
"Must have something to do with the dreaming." Sara drifted up. She looked grim. She did not like what was happening even a little, the snow or the way we had to cope with it. But she bit her tongue. She understood that it was now too late to be a fussy mom. Like it or not, her boy was carrying us all right now. One Eye limped along using a staff somebody had made for him from one of the smaller bamboo weapons. I did not know if it was still armed. Very likely so. He being One Eye, he told me,
"I'm not going to last at this, little girl, but I'll go as long as I can."
"Show Tobo what to do and let him take over as soon as he's got it. Let Goda carry the pickaxe and you get up on the horse. Advise from there." The old man just nodded instead of finding some reason to argue, betraying his true weakness. Goblin scowled at me, though, assuming he was going to get a large ration of unsolicited counsel. But he shrugged off the temptation to debate. "Tobo, hold up.
You really understand what we have to do today?
I've got it, Sleepy.
Then give your grandmother the key. Where's that horse buddy of mine? Get up here, you. Carry one eye. I noted that the white crow had left the beast's back. In fact, the bird was nowhere to be seen. Up you go, old man.
Who you calling old, little girl?
One eye drew himself up as tall as he got. You, so old you've gotten shorter than me. Get your tail up there. I really want to get there today. I offered Goblin a hard look, just in case he got a notion to try poking sticks in the spokes. He just looked back blankly, or maybe blandly. Spoiled brat me. I got my way. The ruined fortress loomed out of weakly falling snow around what felt like noon. Once Tobo got the hang of discovering the boundaries well enough to keep up with Goblin, the band began moving at a pace limited only by Mother Goda's capacities, and she seemed taken by a sudden urge to hasten toward whatever destiny awaited whoever arrived with the key. My natural pessimism went almost entirely unrewarded. Had Iqbal's boys not discovered the wonders of snowballs, I would have had nothing to complain about at all. Even then I would have been entertained, had not a few wild volleys of missiles not strayed my way. We arrived at the chasm Mergen had mentioned. A tear in the face of the plain, rent by powers almost unimaginable. The earthquake responsible had been felt as far away as Taglios. It had flattened whole cities this side of the Don de Preche. I wondered if it had wrought as much destruction in the other worlds connected to the plain. I also wondered if the quake had been natural in origin. Had it been caused by some premature effort of Kina's to rise and shine? Swan! Willow Swan! Get up here! Mother Goda had halted at the lip of the chasm simply because there was no way for her to go forward. The rest of the mob crowded up behind the leaders because, naturally, everyone wanted to see. I snapped. Make a hole, people! Make a hole! Let the man get up here! I stared at the wrecked fortress. Shattered was too strong a description, but its state of disrepair went way beyond neglect, too. I supposed if the original golem garrison were still around, it would be in perfect condition, and right now the whole crew would be outside dusting off the snow patches attached to every little roughness of the stone. Swan grumbled,
You need to make up your mind, darling. You want me to look out for the Radisha, or...
Never mind, I don't have time. I'm cold and I'm cranky, and I want to change that. Look at this crack. Is this the way it was before? Because even though it's pretty impressive, it's nowhere as huge as Mergen made me think it would be. Everybody but Iqbal's baby can skip across this. Swan studied the gap in the plain. Immediately evident to any eye was the fact that there were no sharp edges. The stones seemed to have softened and oozed like taffy.
No, it wasn't like this at all. It looks like it's been healing. It's not a quarter as wide as it was. I bet in another generation there won't even be a scar.
So the plane can heal itself, but not so things that were added later. I indicated the fortress, except for the spells protecting the roads.
Apparently.
Start moving across. Swan, stick with Tobo and Goda. Nobody else has any idea where to go from here.
There you are.
I answered an impatient caw from above. If I kind of squinted and looked sideways, I could make out the white crow perched on the battlements looking down, still muttering to himself, though somewhat good-naturedly. Swan stepped across the crack, slipped, fell, skidded, got up exercising a string of out-of-shape northern expletives. Everyone else laughed. I summoned Runmust and Riverwalker. I want you two to figure out how to get the animals and carts across. Draft Suvrin if you want. He claims he's had some minor experience in practical engineering. And keep reminding everyone that if they remain calm and cooperative, We'll all get to sleep in a warm, dry place tonight. Well, maybe dry. Warm was probably too much to expect. Uncle Doge and Tobo helped Mother Gota across. Sara followed. Several other Nuangbo followed her. That made an awful lot of Nuangbo concentrated in one place suddenly. My paranoia began to quiver and narrow its eyes suspiciously. I said, "Goblin, One Eye, come along. Slink? Where are you? Come with us." Slink I could count on to be quick and deadly, and as morally reluctant as a spear when I pointed and said, "Kill." Uncle Doge did not fail to note the fact that even now I trusted him only incompletely. He seemed both irked and amused. He told me,
"There isn't anything for our people here, Analyst. This is all for Tobo's benefit."
That's good. That's good. I wouldn't want the future of the company to be placed in the slightest risk. Doge frowned, disappointed by my sarcasm.
"I have not won your heart yet, Stone Soldier."
"How could you? You keep calling me names and won't even explain."
"All will become clear, I fear."
"Of course. Once we reach the land of unknown shadows, right? You'd better hope there aren't any half-truths or outright cover-ups in your doctrine. All evil dies there in endless death. It could still be true." Doge responded with a baleful look, but it seemed neither angry nor calculating. I said, "Swan, show us the way." Chapter 81.
"I think this is as far as I can take you,"
Swan told me. He spoke slowly, as though having trouble sorting out his thoughts.
"I don't get it. Stuff keeps going away. I know I was farther inside than this. I know all the things we did. But when I try to remember anything specific, I lose everything between the time I got to this point until sometime during the gallop back. Stuff comes to me all the time when I'm not trying. I do remember that. Maybe Catcher messed up my brain somehow."
"There's an all-time understatement,"
Goblin muttered. Swan ignored Goblin. He complained,
"We were actually off the plane before I realized that we were the only ones who would be coming out."
I was not sure I believed that, but it did not matter now. I grunted, suggested, "How about you make a guess? Maybe your soul will remember what your brain can't."
"First you need to get some light in here."
"What do I have wizards for?" I asked the gloom. "Certainly not anything useful or practical like providing a light. They wouldn't need one. They can see in the dark." Goblin muttered something unflattering about the sort of woman who indulges in sarcasm. He told Swan,
"Sit down and let me look at your head."
"Let me,"
Tobo enthused at the same time.
"Let me try to make a light. I can do this one."
He did not wait for permission. Filaments of lemon and silver light crawled over his upraised hands, swift and eager. The darkness surrounding us retreated, I thought reluctantly.
"Wow,"
I said. "Look at him."
"He has the strength and enthusiasm of youth,"
One Eye conceded. I glanced back. He was still astride the black stallion, wearing a smug look but obviously exhausted. The white crow was perched in front of him. It studied Tobo with one eye while considering our surroundings with the other. It seemed amused. Then One Eye began to chuckle. Tobo squealed in surprise.
"Wait! Stop! Goblin! What's happening?"
The worms of light were snaking up his arms. They would not respond to his insistence that they desist. He started slapping himself. One Eye and Goblin began to laugh. Meantime, the two of them had done something to Swan to clarify his mind. The man looked like he had just sucked down a tall, frosty mug of self-confident recollection. Sara saw nothing funny in Tobo's situation. She screamed at the wizards to do something. She was almost incoherent, which betrayed how much stress she inflicted upon herself. Doge told her,
"He isn't in any danger, Sara. He just let himself get distracted. It happens. It's part of learning."
Or words to that effect, several times, before Sara calmed down and began to look defiant and sheepish at the same time. Goblin told Tobo,
"I'll take it till you get your concentration back."
And in a moment, there was light enough to see the walls of the huge chamber. Someone who is skilled at something always makes it look easy. The little bald wizard was no exception. He told One Eye,
"Help Swan keep his head clear."
I thought the place looked like a nice change from sleeping out in the weather. I wished there was fuel we could burn to heat it.
"Whither now?" I asked Swan. For some time I had been silently regretting not having caught Mergen while I was dreaming, so I could have gotten reliable directions.
The White Crow squawked and launched itself, leaving One Eye cursing because it had swatted him in the face with its wings. I was starting to understand the beast. "Somebody see where it goes? One of you sorcerer geniuses want to send a light with it?" Tobo had received control of his light again, and had it working in good form, but it took all his attention to manage it. I hoped he outgrew his more confidence than sense stage before he took a really big bite of disaster. Uncle Doge trailed the crow at a dignified pace. I supposed I ought to contribute something more than executive decisions, so I followed him. A ball of leprous green light from behind overtook me and made a nest in my tangled hair. My scalp began to itch. I had a suspicion One Eye might be sneering at my personal hygiene, which, I confess, sometimes became the victim of a negligent attitude. Sort of. "This'll teach me to take my darn helmet off," I grumbled. I refused to allow him to flash me his smug, toothless grin by not looking back. I had not been wearing an actual helmet. God save me, that would have been cold. I had been wearing a leather helmet liner, which had been keeping my ears from getting frostbitten. Barely. Winter. It was one of those things the planning team had not foreseen. I hurried past Doge, who was startled when he saw my hair. Then he grinned as big as ever I had seen him do. I tossed him a bloodthirsty scowl. Unfortunately, to do so I had to turn around far enough to see One Eye and Goblin suddenly stop exchanging hand slaps and snickers. Even Sara turned slightly sideways to conceal her amusement. "All right. So suddenly I am the clown princess of the company, eh?" We would see. Those two would... I realized that they had lured me into accepting their system of thought. Before long, I would be setting traps so I could get even first. The crow cawed. It was down on the cold stone floor. It danced back and forth, suddenly impatient. Its talons clicked softly. I dropped to my knees. It let me get almost within touching distance before it flopped farther into the darkness. More light took life behind us as people and animals came inside, making the predictable racket. Every new arrival had to know what was going on. The crow became a silhouette if I lowered my head and looked at it with my cheek against the floor. I told Doge, "There's light coming from somewhere. This must be where the captured got into the inner fortress." I got down on my belly. There was a definite gap in a wall of stone so dark it seemed unseeable, even in the available light. I could not make out anything on the other side. Doge got down and placed his own cheek on the floor.
"Indeed."
I called, "We need some more light over here, and maybe some tools. River, run must. Have those people start setting up some kind of camp, and see what you can do about shutting out the cold. That would be difficult. There were several large gaps in the outside wall. Goblin and One Eye stopped grinning like fools and came forward dressed in their business faces. They kept Tobo right there with them, determined to teach him their trade quickly, hands-on. With more light, it was easier to see what the bird meant me to see, which had to be the crack Soulcatcher had sealed after working her wicked spells on the captured. "There any spells or booby traps here?" I asked.
"The little girl's a genius," One Eye grumbled.
His speech had grown a little slurred. He needed rest badly.
"The bird strutted through and didn't go up in smoke, right? That suggest anything?"
"No spells," Goblin said. "Don't mind him. He's just cranky because him and Goda haven't had no privacy for a week."
"I'm gonna fit you out for all the privacy you'll need for a couple of aeons, runt man. I'm gonna plant your wrinkled old ass."
"Enough!
Let's see if we can make the hole any bigger." The crow made impatient noises on the other side. It had to have some connection with the captured, even if it was not Mergen operating from some lost corner of time. Certainly I hoped it was not Mergen from the future. That would imply a less than successful effort on our part now. I grumbled and snarled. I stamped back and forth while half a dozen men expanded the hole, every one of them grousing about the shortage of light. I did not contribute much as a human candle either. Maybe the thing in my hair was Goblin and One Eye offering commentary on how bright I was. Though I doubted that after only 200 years, they could yet have developed that much cleverness and subtlety. A larger and larger crowd piled up behind me.
"River," I growled.
"I said you should have these people do something useful. Tobo, get back from there. You want a boulder to fall on your head?"
A voice behind me suggested,
"You're to get more light on it so you can see if you need to do any shoring."
I turned.
"Slink?"
"There were miners in my family."
"Then you're as near an expert as we've got." One Eye jabbed a thumb at Goblin.
"The dwarf here has sapper experience. He helped undermine the walls at Timber."
His face split in an ugly grin. Goblin squeaked a definite clue that Timber was an episode he did not recall fondly. I did not remember any mention of a Timber in the annals. Reason suggested that the referenced event must have taken place long before Croker became analyst, which he had done at an early age. Two of Croker's more immediate predecessors, Milo Ladora and Kanwa Scar, had been so lax in their duties that little is known about their time, other than what their successors have reconstructed from oral tradition and the memories of survivors. It was during that era that Croker, Otto, and Hagope joined the band. Croker says little about those days himself. "Am I to take it, then, that I shouldn't invest unlimited faith in Goblin's engineering skills?" One Eye cawed like a crow.
"As an engineer, our bitty buddy makes a wonderful lumberjack. Things fall down wherever he goes."
Goblin growled like a mastiff issuing a warning.
"See? This here skinny little bald-egg genius sold the old man the notion of sneaking into his burg timber by tunneling under its walls, deep down. Because the earth was soft, it'd be easy."
One Eye snorted as he talked, his laughter barely under control.
"And he was right. It was easy. When his tunnel caved in, the wall fell down, and the rest of us charged through the gap and sorted them timberinos out."
Goblin grumbled.
"And about 5 days later, somebody remembered the miners."
"Somebody was just plain damned lucky he had a friend as good as me to dig him out. The old man just wanted to put up a gravestone."
Goblin growled some more.
"Not so. And the real truth is, the tunnel never would have collapsed if this two-legged, overripe dog turd hadn't been playing one of his stupid games. You know, I almost forgot. I never did pay you back for that. You should have never brought it up, you human prune. Damn. You almost went and died on me before I got you paid off. I knew you were up to no good. You had that stroke on purpose, didn't you?
Of course I did, you nitwit. Every chance I get, I try to die just so's you can't backstab me no more. You want to be that way? I saved your ass, and you want to be that way? Ain't no fool like an old fool. Bring it on, you hairless little toady frog. I may be slowed down a step the last couple years, but I'm still 3 steps faster and 10 torches brighter than any lily white.
Boys, I snapped. Children, we have work to do here. They must have driven the whole company crazy when they were young and had the energy to keep it up all the time. As of this moment, all the slates are clean of anything that happened before I was born. Just open me a hole so I can go see what we have to do next. The two wizards did not stop growling and muttering and threatening and trying to sabotage one another in small ways, but they did lend their claimed expertise to the effort to open the gap. Chapter 82. Once the opening had been expanded enough to use, there was a brief debate about who would use it first. The accord was universal. Not me. But when I squatted down to duck walk forward into the shadows, in hopes I could get a look at what might eat me a few seconds before its jaws snapped shut, several gentlemen turned all noble and chivalrous. I suspect it was significant that two of them, Swan and Suvrin, were not company brothers. Goblin grumbled,
"All right, all right. Now you're making us look bad. All of you get out of the way."
He bustled forward. He did not have to duck. I did, just slightly, as I followed him through. I did not need anyone to be noble or chivalrous or to go in before me.
"There is no god but God," I muttered. "His works are vast and mysterious."
I was 5 steps inside and had just bumped into Goblin, who had stopped to stare as well. "I presume that's the golem demon Shvetya.
Or his ugly little brother."
Mergen had not kept me posted on the golem's state. At last report, it had been just a single earth tremor short of plunging into a bottomless abyss, still nailed to a huge wooden throne by means of a number of silver daggers. I observed, "It appears the plane has been healing itself in here, too." I eased forward. There was still a vertiginous abyss. I had to close my eyes momentarily while I regained my equilibrium. Shvetya remained poised over it, but the gap clearly was narrower than Mergen had described. In closing, the surface had pushed the wooden throne upward somewhat. Shvetya was no longer in momentary peril of falling. It looked like a few decades would see him lying there with his nose pressed into healed stone, the overturned throne on top of him still. Willow Swan invited himself to join me. He said,
"That thing hasn't moved since last time."
I countered, "Thought you couldn't remember anything."
"Whatever the short farts did, it seems to be working. I recognize things when I see them."
Goblin told Swan,
"Considering what could still happen if Shvetya starts jumping around, holding still seems like a pretty good idea, don't you think?"
"Could you hold still for 15 years?
I said. "He's held still a lot longer than that, Swan. He's been nailed to that throne for hundreds of years. Or even thousands. He has to have been nailed down since before deceivers fleeing Raedrenak came here on their way to other worlds and hid the books of the dead." That observation got me some looks, particularly from Master Centaraxita. I had not yet shared the tales I had gleaned from Mergen. Else he would have stomped them good at the time, They would have looked like the kind of thing he was put here to guard against. I think.
Who nailed him down?
Goblin asked.
I don't know. Might be a handy piece of information. You'd want to keep an eye on a guy who could do that kind of thing.
I would,
Swan agreed. He grinned nervously.
It's listening, I said. I moved along the edge of the abyss several steps, squatted. From there I could see the demon's eyes. They were open a crack. I could also see that there were three of them instead of two, the third being in the center of the forehead, above and between the other two. This point had not come up before, though it was the sort of thing you would expect of a Goonie-style demon. The oversight became self-explanatory as soon as the demon sensed my scrutiny. The third eye closed and vanished. I asked Swan, "That throne looked like it's solidly wedged?"
"Yeah, why?"
"Just wondering if we could move it without losing it down that crack."
"I'm no engineer, but it looks to me like you'd really have to work at it to dump it down there now. Obviously, it could go. One really stupid move? It's a hell of a deep hole, but..."
The curious kept piling up behind us. Their chatter was becoming annoying. Every single whisper turned into a gaggle of echoes that made the place seem more haunted than it was.
"Everybody be quiet! I can't hear myself think!"
I must have sounded nastier than I intended. People shut up and gawked. I asked, "Does anyone see a way to get that thing turned right side up and pushed back away from the gap?"
"How come you'd want to do that?" one I asked. "Quit shoving, Junior,"
Suvrin asked.
"Using equipment we have on hand?"
"Yes. And it would have to get done today. I want the majority of these people back on the road south at first light tomorrow."
"That means using brute force. Right now, some of us would have to get on the other side of the fissure and lift the top of the throne through so people and animals on this side could get the leverage to pull it on up using ropes."
Swan said,
"You try to stand it up the way it is there, the bottom end will just slide off the edge. Then it's a grand ride off to the entrails of the earth."
"How come you'd want to do that?"
One Eye demanded again. I ignored him again. I concentrated on the argument spreading outward from Suvrin and Swan. I let it run for several minutes. Then I announced, "Suvrin seems to be the only one here with a positive view, so he's in charge. Suvrin, draft anybody you want. Help yourself to any resources you need. Sit Shvetya back up for me. You hear that, steadfast guardian? Gentlemen, if you have any ideas, feel free to share them with Mr. Suvrin." Suvrin said,
"I can't. I don't. I shouldn't. I guess the first thing we'd better do is get a solid idea of how much weight we're dealing with. And we'll have to rig up some way to get across the gap. Mr. Swan, you handle that. Young Mr. Tobo, I understand you're skilled at mathematics. Suppose you help me calculate how much mass we're dealing with here."
Tobo grinned and headed for the throne, not at all intimidated by the demon. "One adjustment," I said. "I need Swan with me. He's been here before. Runmust, you and Iqbal figure out how to get across. Willow, come with me." Out of earshot of the others, Swan asked,
"What's going on?"
I didn't want to remind anybody that the company got this far once before. Somebody might recall a grudge against the man who made it impossible for our predecessors to go any farther.
"Oh, thanks, I guess."
He glanced at the clot of Nguyen Bo. Mother Goda continued to nurture her grudge. She had a son somewhere down under this stone. "I may just have a strange perspective. I do believe all of us should accept responsibility for our actions, but I'm not sure we ever understand why we do some things. Do you know why you cut Soulcatcher loose? I'd bet you've spent the odd minute here and there trying to figure that out." You'd win. Except it'd be more like the odd year here and there. And I still can't explain it. She did something to me somehow, just with her eyes, all the way across the plain, probably manipulating my feelings about her sister. When the time came, it seemed like the right thing to do. I never had a doubt until it was all over and we were on the run.
And she kept her word. He understood.
She gave me everything her eyes promised. Everything I could never have from the sister I really wanted. Whatever her failings, Soulcatcher keeps her word.
Sometimes we get what we want and find out that it wasn't what we needed.
No shit. Story of my life, Sleepy.
Around 50 people came onto the plane. 2 of you got away. 13 died on the road trying. The rest are still out here somewhere. And you helped put them where they are. So I'm going to need you to show me. Are you still blind in the memory, or have you started to remember?
Oh, those spells took. It's coming back. But not necessarily organized the same way that it happened. So bear with me when I seem a little confused.
I understand. I kept an eye on the others as we talked. Sarah seemed to be putting herself under a lot of unnecessary stress. Doge looked ferociously ready to seize the day, should an opportunity pop up. Goda was nagging one eye about something, while keeping one grim eye aimed Swan's way. Goblin was trying to get the mist projector set up amidst a jostling crowd. I noted, "There seems to be more light than Mergen reported."
"Tons more. And it's warmer, too. If I was allowed to guess, mine would be that it had something to do with the healing that's going on."
I did feel overdressed for the indoor weather. It was not hot, but it was warmer than the plain outside, and there was no wind biting.
"Where are the captured?" "There was a stairway over there. We must have gone a mile down into the earth."
"You carried 35 unconscious people down there and got back in time to get away from the evening shadows? Without killing yourself?"
"Ketcher did most of it. She has a spell that makes things float through the air. We roped the people together and pulled them along like a string of sausages. She did the pulling, actually. I stayed on the uphill end, more or less. At first. Because the stair has some twists and turns. We had trouble getting them around the corners. But a lot less trouble than if we'd carried them one at a time."
I nodded. I knew of other instances when Ketcher had used the same sorcery. Seemed like a handy one to have. We could use it right here, right now, to hoist my future buddy Chevet.